You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Nathan Engliner is the author most recently of the short story collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, as well as the internationally best-selling story collection For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, and the novel The Ministry of Special Cases. Great titles all. Englander was selected as one of the 20 writers for the 21st century by The New Yorker, and he's received numerous prizes, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Penn Malamud Award, and the Sue Kaufman Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. This year, along with the publication of his new collection, also saw the premiere of his play, The 27th Man, at the Public Theater in Manhattan, as well as the translation of the New American Haggadah, edited by Jonathan Safran Foer, which some of you might be using for your seders this spring. In Englander's new collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, absurdity and profundity easily commingle. Where else will you find an Orthodox Jew with the munchies, smoking dope from a pipe made out of an apple? Seemingly simple situations widen out in historical and ethical perspective. The mood veers from hilarity to sobriety without our seeing it coming. As the writer Stacy Schiff wrote recently in the New York Times Book Review, the aroma of Judaism permeates Englander's book as the smell of simis does a house. If you don't know simis, a little prune, a little carrot, a little honey, you know, just do it together. Echoes of the two Isaacs, Bathsheba Singer and Babel, can be heard throughout the pages, and Gogol is somewhere in the neighborhood, too, and maybe Woody Allen as well, pacing around the corner. Nathan will discuss his stories tonight with Los Angeles Times book critic David Yulin, whose most recent book is The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time. Los Angeles readers, I'm sure you will agree, are fortunate to have such an insightful and passionate book critic writing regularly for us. David's essays and criticisms have appeared in many publications, and his Writing Los Angeles, a literary anthology, won a 2002 California Book Award. So please join me in welcoming David Yulin and Nathan Englander to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thanks. Let's stay over here. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. I can sort of see you. I heard you clapping, which is generous. I'm going to read for like 7 minutes and 42 seconds so you can sort of get a feel for my voice, and then, as promised, we will be in conversation. But yes, I always, I go to lots of readings, not always when I'm facing the other way, but it really helps me. It's something, we'll see if it helps in this case, but there's certain writers whose voices I hear for the rest of my life after I hear them read, like Tim O'Brien or Laurie Moore or, Nora Ephron, who I miss, but people like that who, it really just changes their writing for me. That doesn't count towards my 7 minutes. Okay, I'll read from the title story now. What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. They're in our house maybe 10 minutes, and already Mark's lecturing us on the Israeli occupation. Mark and Lauren live in Jerusalem, and people from there think it gives them the right. Mark's looking all stoic and nodding his head. If we had what you have down here in South Florida, he says and trails off. Yep, he says, and he's nodding again. We'd have no troubles at all. You do have what we have, I tell him. All of it. Sun and palm trees, old Jews and oranges, and the worst drivers around. At this point, I say, we've probably got more Israelis than you. Debbie, my wife, she puts a hand on my arm or signal that I'm taking a tone or interrupting someone's story, sharing something private, or making an inappropriate joke. That's my cue. And I'm surprised, considering how much I get it, that she ever lets go of my arm. Yes, you've got it all now, Mark says, even terrorists. I look to Lauren. She's the one my wife has the relationship with, the one who should take charge. But Lauren isn't going to give her husband any signal. She and Mark ran off to Israel 20 years ago and turned Hasidic. And neither of them will put a hand on the other in public, not for this, not to put out a fire. Wasn't Muhammad Atta living right here before 9/11? Mark says, and now he pantomimes pointing out houses. Goldberg, 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 Atta. How'd you miss him in this place? Other side of town, I say. That's what I'm talking about. That's what you have that we don't. Other sides of town, wrong sides of the tracks, space upon space. And now he's fingering a granite countertop in our kitchen, looking out into the living room and the dining room, staring through the kitchen windows out at the pool. All this house, he says, and one son. Can you imagine? No, Lauren says, and then she turns to us, backing him up. You should see how we live with 10. 10 kids, I say. We could get your reality show with that here in the States, help you get a bigger place. The hand is back pulling at my sleeves. Pictures, Debbie says. I want to see the girls. We all follow Lauren into the den for her purse. Do you believe it? Mark says. 10 girls. And the way it comes out of his mouth is the first time I like the guy, the first time I think about giving him a chance. Facebook and Skype brought Deb and Lauren back together. They were glued at the hip growing up, went to school together their whole lives, yeshiva school, all girls. Out in Queens through high school and then riding the subway together to one called Central in Manhattan. They stayed best friends forever until I married Deb and turned her secular. And soon after that, Lauren met Mark and they went off to the Holy Land and went from Orthodox to ultra-Orthodox, which to me sounds like a repackaged detergent. Orthodox Ultra, now with more deep healing power. Because of that, we're supposed to call them Shoshana and Yerucham. Deb's been doing it. I'm just not saying their names. You want some water? I offer. Coke in the can? You, which of us? Mark says. You both, I say. I've got whiskey. Whiskey's kosher too, right? If it's not, I'll kosher it up real fast, he says, pretending to be easygoing. And right then, he takes off that big black hat and plops down on the couch in the den. Lauren's holding the verticals aside and looking out at the yard. Two girls from Forest Hills, she says. Whoever thought we'd be the mothers of grown-ups? Trevor's 16, Deb says. You may think he's a grown-up, and he may think he's a grown-up, but we are not convinced. Well, Lauren says, then whoever thought we'd have kids raised to think it's normal to have coconuts crashing out back and lizards climbing the walls? Right then is when Trev comes padding into the den, all 6 feet of him, plaid pajama bottoms dragging on the floor and t-shirt full of holes. He's just woken up, and you can tell he's not sure if he's still dreaming. We told him we had guests. But there's Trev, staring at this man in the black suit, a beard resting on the middle of his stomach. And Lauren, I'd met her once before, right when Deb and I got married. But 10 girls and 1,000 Shabbos dinners later. Well, she's a big woman in a bad dress and a giant blonde Marilyn Monroe wig. Seeing them at the door, I can't say I wasn't shocked myself, but the boy, he can't hide it on his face. Hey, he says. And then Deb's on him, preening and fixing his hair and hugging him. Trevi, this is my best friend from childhood, she says. This is Shoshana, and this is Mark, I say. Yerucham, Mark says, and sticks out a hand. Trev shakes it, then Trev sticks out his hand, polite, to Lauren. She looks at it, just hanging there in the air, offered. I don't shake, she says, but I'm so happy to see you, like meeting my own son, I mean it, she says. And here she starts to cry for real. And she and Deb are hugging, and Deb's crying too, and the boys, we just stand there until Mark looks at his watch and gets himself a good manly grip on Trev's shoulder. Sleeping until 3 on a Sunday, man, those were the days, Mark says, a regular little rump of foreskin. Trev looks at me, and I want to shrug, but Mark's also looking, so I don't move. Trev just gives us both his best teenage glare and edges out of the room. As he does, he says, baseball practice, and take my car keys off the hook by the door to the garage. There's gas, I say. They let them drive here at 16, Mark says. Insane. So what brings you, I say, after all these years? Deb's too far away to grab at me, but her face says it all. Was I supposed to know? I say, geez, Deb must have told me. She told me for sure, my fault. My mother, Mark says. She's failing and my father's getting old and they come to us for Sukkot every year. You know, I know the holidays, I say. They used to fly out to us for Sukkot and Pesach both. But they can't fly now, and I just wanted to get over while things are still good. We haven't been in America. Oh, gosh, Lauren says. I'm afraid to think how long it's been. More than 10 years. 12, she says. 12 years ago. With the kids, it's just impossible until enough of them are big. This might be, and now she plops down on the couch. This might be my first time in a house with no kids under the roof in that long. Oh, my, I'm serious. How weird. I feel faint. And when I say faint, she says, standing up, giving an oddly girlish spin around, what I mean is giddy. How do you do it? Deb says. 10 kids. I really do want to hear. That's when I remember. I forgot your drink, I say to Mark. Yes, his drink. That's how, Lauren says. That's how we cope. And that's how the four of us end up back at the kitchen table with a bottle of vodka between us. I'm not one to get drunk on a Sunday afternoon, but I tell you, with a plan to spend the day with Mark, I jump at the chance. Deb's drinking too, but not for the same reason. For her and Lauren, I think they were living a little bit of the wild times. The very small window when they were together, barely grown up, two young women living in New York on the edge of two worlds, and they just look, the both of them, so overjoyed to be reunited. I think they're half celebrating and half can't handle how intense the whole thing is. Deb says that she's already on her second. This is really racy for us. I mean, really racy. We try not to drink much at all these days. We think it sets a bad example for Trevor. It's not good to drink in front of them right at that age when they're all transgressive. He's suddenly so interested in that kind of thing. I'm just happy when he's interested in something, I say. Deb slaps at the air. I just don't think it's good to make drinking look like it's fun with a teenager around. Lauren smiles and straightens her wig. Does anything we do look fun to our kids? I laugh at that. Honestly, I'm really liking her more and more. It's the age limit that does it, Mark says. It's the whole American puritanical thing, the 21-year-old drinking age and all that. We don't make a big deal about it in Israel, and so the kids, they don't even notice alcohol. Except for the foreign workers on Fridays, you hardly see anyone drunk at all. The workers and the Russians, Lauren says. The Russian immigrants, he says. That's a whole separate matter. Most of them, you know, not even Jews. What does that mean? I say. It means matrilineal descent is what it means, Mark says. It means with the Ethiopians there were conversions. But Deb wants to keep us away from politics. And the way we're arranged, me in between them and Deb opposite, it's a round table, our kitchen table. She practically has to throw herself across to grab hold of my arm. Fix me another, she says. And here she switches the subject to Mark's parents. How's the visit been going? She says, her face all somber. How are your folks holding up? Deb is very interested in Mark's parents. They're Holocaust survivors. And Deb has what can only be called an unhealthy obsession with the idea of that generation being gone. Don't get me wrong. It's important to me, too. I care, too. All I'm saying is there's healthy and unhealthy, and my wife, she gives the subject a lot of time. Do you know, she'll say to me and Trevor, just absolutely out of nowhere, World War II veterans die at a rate of 1,000 a day. What can I say? Mark says. My mother's a very sick woman, and my father, he tries to keep his spirits up. He's a tough guy. I'm sure, I say. And then I look in my drink all serious and give a shake of my head. They really are amazing. Who? Mark says. Fathers? I look back up, and they're all three staring at me. Survivors, I say, seeing I jump the gun. There's good and bad, Mark says, like anyone else, and then he laughs, though there isn't anyone else in my parents' place. Lauren says, you should see it. The whole of Carmel Lake Village, it's like a DP camp with a billiards room. They're all there. One tells the other, Mark says, and they follow. It's amazing. From Europe to New York, and now for the end of their lives, again the same place. Tell them that crazy story, Lauren says. Tell them, Yuri. Tell us, Deb says. And I can see in her eyes that she wants it to be one of those stories of a guy who spent 3 years hiding inside one of those cannons they use for the circus. And at the end of the war, a righteous Gentile comes out all joyous and fires him through a hoop and into a tub of water where he discovers his lost son breathing through a straw. So you can picture my father, Mark says. In the old country, he went to cheder, had the payas and all that. But in America, a classic galoose monger. He looks more like you than me. It's not from him that I get this, he says, pointing at his beard. Shoshana and I, we know, I say. So my father, they've got a nice 9-hole course, a driving range, some greens for the practice putting, and my daddy's at the clubhouse. I go with him. He wants to work out in the gym, he says, tells me I should come get some exercise. And he tells me, and here Mark points at his feet, sliding a leg out from under the table so we can see his big black clodhoppers. You can't wear those Shabba shoes on the treadmill. You need the sneakers, you know, sports shoes, he says. And I tell him, I know what sneakers are. I didn't forget my English any more than your Yiddish is gone. And so he says, Achshenem dank dir im pupik, just to show me who's who. The point, Lauren says, tell them the point. So he's sitting in the locker room trying to pull a sock on, which is, at that age, basically the whole workout in itself. It's no quick business. And I see while I'm waiting, and I can't believe it, I nearly pass out, the guy next to him, the number on his arm, it's 3 before my father's number, you know, in sequence. What do you mean? Deb says. I mean the number tattooed. It's the same as my father's camp number, digit for digit, but my father's ends in an 8, and this guy's, it ends in a 5. That's the only difference. I mean, they're separated by 2 people. And I look at this guy, I've never seen him before in my life, so I say, excuse me, sir, to the guy, and he just says, you with the Chabad? I don't want anything but to be left alone. I already got candles at home. I tell him, no, I'm not. I'm just here visiting my father. And to my father, I say, do you know this gentleman? Have you two met? I'd really like to introduce you if you haven't. And they look each other over for what I promise you is minutes, actual minutes. It is with kavod, I say this with respect for my father, but it is like watching a pair of big beige manatees sitting on a bench, each with one sock on. They're just looking each other up and down, everything slow. And then my father says, I seen him around. The other guy, he says, yes, I've seen. You're both survivors, I tell them. Look, look, I say, the numbers. And they look. They're the same, I say. And they both hold out their arm to look at the little ashen tattoos. The same, I tell them. And to my father, I say, do you get it? The same, except his, it's right ahead of yours. Look, compare. So they look, they compare. And to us now, Mark's eyes are popping out of his head. I mean, think about it, he says. Around the world, surviving the unsurvivable, these 2 old guys end up with enough money to retire to Carmel Lake and play golf every day. So I say to my dad, he's right ahead of you, I say. Look, a 5, I say, and yours is an 8. And the other guy looks, and my father looks. And my father says, all that means is he cut ahead of me in line. There, same as here. This guy's a cutter, I just didn't want to say. Blow it out your ear, the other guy says. And that's it. Then they get back to putting on socks. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to talk for a while, and then we're going to turn it over to some questions from you guys. Let's start by talking about that story.
Sure.
Which is, it loaded in a lot of ways. You've talked years ago when you wrote the story The Tumblers, which is a story that deals with the Holocaust, about kind of the dangers or your own reservations about addressing Holocaust materials in your fiction. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that, those reservations, and then maybe how they did or didn't come out.
Oh, wow. It's a pleasure talking to you already. Let's start with the small questions. But yeah, that.
Well, we have a limited amount of time.
Yeah, that's the whole reason. That's how this book got born. Was literally like I'd spent. So the story, The Tumblers. I always have to remember to explain things. The Tumblers is a story about. It's a Holocaust fable, and just thinking. You know, when I was very little and starting writing, but just thinking about this idea of how pervasive the Holocaust is. I grew up, you know, a religious kid. I grew up on the stories of Chelm, which are wonderful fables about the fools of this town. And I thought, you know, there actually isn't real, in the real Chelm, in Chelm, there was, you know, a concentration camp. But I thought the Holocaust was so pervasive it would have hunted even, like, fabled world. So it's basically this town is being rounded up, and this group of Hasidim get on there. They end up getting on the wrong train, you know, in their underwear and being confused as circus performers, as acrobats. But the point is, you know, it was a maddening story to write, and I'd written it for, you know, I draft compulsively. I wrote that story for years, and I went so crazy writing it. You know, I have like a 20-page version that gets them, you know, up till 1985, and I have like a 150-page version that gets them like 8 steps into town. The point is, I would draft and draft, and I'd written it so many times forward that I ended up the version that's in that first book I wrote backwards. I would write like a page and a half from the end, and I would just to see it anew. I wrote from the end to the front, but it's very strange. Like, one dreams of being a writer. At least I did. That's all I ever wanted to do. And every life is built of stages. You dream of being a writer, and then if you get to be a writer, then one has to learn how to live as a writer, and then one has to learn how to absorb. You know, it's very natural for me to sit here. I hope I seem like myself, but this wasn't a natural thing. You usually sit there and face this way. You know, like, this is how I see most of my events, this way. But you know, it's very strange to suddenly be called a Jewish writer or a kind of writer, and we can talk about that too. But even to deal with material, like, there's always questions. Oh, has the Holocaust been written about enough? You know, I felt I'd already explored this thing, which is a strange notion. You know, like, something's been explored by you, but my brain works a certain way. And I think I was resistant at some point with this last book to giving in to my own brain. But I was living in, it was 2009, I was living in Berlin at the American Academy, and I was living in a house that's the whole history of modern Germany. So it was a house built by a Jewish banker, by Hans Arnhold, and then it was taken over, I think, by the SS Minister of Finance. You know, just because you're evil doesn't mean you have good, don't have good taste. You know, like, so that's all these, like, beautiful houses. And then it was taken over, you know, by, it became, after the war, it was the American Officers Club. And then when the wall came down, it's this place about East-West understanding, literally the whole history of the place. It happens to be on Lake Wannsee, which the house, a beautiful house, as beautiful as ours across the lake, like, still a beautiful house with a lovely sunroom with wrought iron furniture that you love, is where Eichmann is secretary, the Nazis sat there and put the final solution into play. And I'm sitting there with these ideas for these stories in my head, and I'm sitting there thinking, like, do I write about this again? And I'm looking at the lake, you know, this is, and I'm thinking, can a lake be evil? Can a lake contain evil? Like, can a house contain evil? Like, what is this, you know, how does history move? And I just thought, like, yes, this has been written about. Yes, I've written about it. And I started to think, you know, in a sense, to be comfortable with how my head works. But what I thought was, when should you stop writing about something? And I thought, when it is no longer relevant. And then I began to think, so is the Holocaust relevant? You know, and I said, when is the past no longer relevant? And the answer I came up with sitting at that table, looking at that lake, was when it no longer informs the future. And I really think, you know what, I don't think anyone has a war now without looking at, you know, Napoleon or you know, Alexander the Great. Like, you're always the three-pronged attack. And I really think, like, if you look, you know, right now Israel, you know, I just got back last week from Israel. It is facing its greatest existential threat ever, more than 48, more than any other time. Literally, its very existence threatened from the inside and from the outside. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, Netanyahu sitting there, the son of a historian, I thought, really, Jewish ideas of, like, strength and weakness and needing to turn to the Americans for help and power and, you know, Jewish destruction and armed Jews, I literally think that the very conception of how the Holocaust is remembered is going to inform, you know, whether we have World War III or not, you know, how those things play out. So yes, in that moment, I felt suddenly free to, if this is all I write about as a theme, you know, and it's a separate aesthetic thing, and that's one issue, but the other is that I now, even the homage part of the story to Carver, I used to be offended by West Side Story and think, there's Romeo and Juliet, we don't need West Side Story, right. You know, but now I understand that it's not only that there's infinite story in the world, but I think you could live with singular story or notion to infinity, like, you know, artistically. Like, I really think with this Carver story, after the book came out, someone sent me a review written by a nice writer, you know, about this story, but I didn't even know, like, the amount of fear, and I'm, you know, we may or may not talk about that too, about the Carver part, but as much as I felt writing this homage to Carver, how terrifying it was to me as a writer to interact with that story, I had no idea that Carver's story, I had no idea, is based on a Chekhov story. You know, and that idea...
I had no idea that Carver story
yes.
was based on
Chekhov's story. So in this notion, it really touched me. Like, this idea, scared as I was, like, you know, have you all read Carver's story about Chekhov dying? Like, I know how you've read his story as much right. as he loves Chekhov. Like, that idea to see, like, oh, there is a continuum. I feel like we could all infinitely write versions of this story and have a very rich literature and fill this building up twice.
Well, I was... Thank you. I was going to ask you about the Carver story, because I'm a... So I will, or we can talk a little bit about the Carver story, because yeah. I mean, to me, that's a really interesting juxtaposition on the one hand, right. and also, frankly, invoking Anne Frank. I mean, this story, you know, it's a triple header in terms of, yeah. of dangerous material in some way. But what I guess I'm, one of the questions, I mean, you have talked about, I mean, is that ever a kind of a stumbling block or something that you want to back away from when you're writing? I mean, you know, did you sort of...
Is what the stumbling block?
All of these sort of these sort of danger areas, you know, in this story, for instance, say Anne Frank or particularly or the Holocaust or the Carver story. I mean, do you try and, as a story like this develops, do you try and talk yourself out of writing it?
The list of my fears is legion. We don't have time for, like, the fears that arise on any given day of disease and all, who knows. Yeah, it's endless. But, yeah, no, I was very aware. It was terrifying. You know, a couple of these stories were truly terrifying, but that was a very scary thing. But I guess it's only, you know, this is, you know, this book came out in hardcover a year ago. Thank you for coming out. Today's, like, first day of paperback. But I start to understand what's happening after the fact. Like, I'm not aware of my interests when I'm writing. I'm aware that I am supposed to be unaware and that I'm telling stories.
Right.
And then after, I discuss these things. But I see that this is really about ownership of material and identity in that same way of me taking ownership. Like, I don't own the stories when I put them out in the world, and I don't own the books if you buy them. Like, but the idea that I can own my imagination is mine, you know. So, and then that idea that if I want to interact, this is how I interact in this story with, again, I don't even, and we can, that's a whole metaphysical thing, but I don't write about the Holocaust ever. I write about how we remember, how it is educated, ownership of, but yeah, and the Carver thing, I think I'm really interested in ownership of identity lately, and it fits in a million different ways in this story. But I guess I pictured when I was writing the story, it was about this relationship with these couples. It was about this game. You know, the story is based on the idea of what I call the Anne Frank game or the Righteous Gentile game or the Who Will Hide Me game. Most writers, I think, work in a different fashion where their early stuff is unbelievably close and then they write further away. But I seem to be writing closer and closer with each book. Like my Argentina novel that I spent a decade on, you know, it's clearly a book. I just saw a friend, he's like, it's really so much about our time. You know, it's, you know, for Jerusalem in 1996, I wrote Argentina in 1976. And it was really with this story back to ownership where I'd never taken a half step back from my life. And my sister, you know, we used to play this game. Again, play just simplifies not spending an hour to talk about what it means to engage with a pathology like that, but how we made order of the world, which is like, who will hide us in the event of a second Holocaust? Like how to trust neighbors, how to trust people. Right. And it was as we started to get older, we don't really do it much anymore. We still do it though. But but about this couple we knew, she said like he would hide us and she would turn us in. You know, and that line's in the story straight like that, but it stayed in me for 20 years because I thought he would totally hide us and then he'd go to work and she would turn us in. It was like so shockingly the right read and I could never see them this because I, you know, it's this idea of who do you, it's like a right. trust game. And with this book, by the way, like in the world, you know, it's amazing to see. I had no idea how many people play that specific game who grew up with it and how it crosses cultures, how people play it, you know, whatever your cultural or national terror is. They play it with slavery, you know, the Underground Railroad. Like just, I've heard so many versions of this terror of people making order of things. But you know, when I was building that separate story, suddenly I pictured the Carver story. Right. I pictured what we talk about when we talk about love, which I hadn't read in, you know, 15 years or something. And I thought, wait a second, when I pictured it, and I saw these two couples sitting at a kitchen table, you know, a bottle of gin in the middle and the changing light of day, and like I pictured it, and then I thought, wait a second, the edition I read had no pictures.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I couldn't tell you, I've reread it since and I reread it for the story. I couldn't tell you that it was in New Mexico, that the guy's a doctor, couldn't remember anything. And then I thought again about all this idea of ownership. I thought, my God, that has become, you know, why I think fiction is a supreme form. It's just words on a page. It's just symbols, which all have specific, yes, they have specific meanings, but we get in plenty of arguments on this planet. You know, just the Constitution alone is going to rip this country in half. Like, we read it very differently. I think we can have some, my read, we can really have some gun control. It's not going to hurt. It's not going to hurt anything. But anyway, but the idea is, I thought, my God, with words, it actually, you make you form memory, you make pictures. And I thought in that idea of ownership that like, oh, that's how the story has become mine. Like it's my what we talk about when we talk about love that I'm remembering. You know, so I built my whole story that way. And then I went back because I would never, the story means so much to me. Then I made it an homage and wove in like the, you know, the sort of seminal first, you know, paragraph ending and certain structural things. I, you know, I really wanted to marry the two.
Right.
But it's
now you, you also, I mean, one of the things that's interesting not about this story and a lot of the other stories in the book, but particularly this story and the Carver story, is that they are stories where fundamentally nothing happens, but everything happens, right? It's two couples sitting around a table, getting drunk, sort of talking, reacquainting themselves,
right.
or, you know, sharing stories. it's the most common undramatic thing in the world, and yet out of that common undramatic scene, high drama takes place. So I'm curious about your thoughts on that in terms of your own fiction or Carver's fiction or just the way fiction operates that way, where you know the drama comes out of the most mundane daily interaction.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, to me it's almost, you're saying something gigantic that is so, you know, the very foundation of how I work, that it, like, it's, yeah, all I can say is true. You know what I'm saying? Like, but it's this idea that that's not my concern. You know, I guess I mentioned it before, it's like why, you know, after all these years, it took me many years to understand why I'm so resistant to being called a Jewish writer, and maybe that's part of it, is because I don't write about Jews, I write about people, and I don't see Jews as a type, a subset of people or a qualified...
Right, you once said Updike is not called a Christian American
writer.
Yeah,
the
right?
Great Christian American writer, right. John Updike, you know what I'm saying? Like, but this idea that I guess, you know, so I'm just telling a story. I guess my... if a world is functioning, it better be multifaceted, and that's what's amazing, what's beautiful to me and lovely to me is when I come out and readers bring different versions of every story to me and see things that I'm not aware of. Because if you're building a reality, if a reality is truly functioning, there's no way that a human brain can hold every facet of it at once. So my point is, none of that is what I'm concerned with. I guess it's, the point is the high drama is... I'm not thinking about entertaining. I'm not thinking about building drama. I am thinking of whatever the story is, you know, pulling me towards, whatever that question, you know, that moment. So I guess, yeah, that it won't stand up. There won't be high drama if that world, right. If you're not shattering the day-to-day world. That's the idea. It is a pressurized form of reality. But I think what my brain is grabbing onto is that pressurized moment, how to build a world that allows, for me, I guess every story back, you know, whether it's Glacidum in their underwear or this story, I don't write anything that I think can work or be, I call it, you know, executing the unexecutable. And I think maybe that's what you're talking about, that there's a moment, they're regular worlds, and, you know, I'm not writing like science fiction or whatever, it's a reality as real as the one I'm in to me, and then there has to be something that's not possible to execute within that, and that is what keeps me interested every day.
And yet, I mean, there's a strong fable component. For instance, in a story like the Peep Show story in here, there's all sorts of the fantastic comes into that narrative fairly quickly and changes the narrative, right? So it isn't you are writing about believable reality, but in some stories that believable reality shifts into some other territory.
Yes, but I guess when you talk about like what makes something genre, like the point is what makes a story then like just a Jewish story is that it has no value outside its Jewishness. Mm-hmm. And what makes something like why are some amazing writers, you know, I'd never read, we were just talking backstage, like I thought I was reading too narrowly. So I'm like, I haven't read science fiction in a million years. I haven't read a mystery in a million years. And it's like why someone, you know, maybe John le Carré, you know, bristles, you know, from his very large house at being called a mystery writer. You know what I'm saying? But, like, the point is, I read Smiley's People. It's a great, it's beautifully written. It's a lovely literary book. The idea is when things are, you know, so for me, I guess you can say a crazy thing. Like, in that Peep Show story, this guy goes to a peep show and the strippers turn into naked rabbis from high school, and there's a sort of a confrontation. And his mother ends up there, and his wife. But the point is, to me, that's not, I guess I can't even conceptualize of it as problematic with this reality, because that's what I think is anything, any element of a story that is necessary to a story is true and viable by virtue of its necessity, and everything else has to be right. So I, like the Argentina novel is, you know, I made up the Ministry of Special Cases, I made up that ministry, and I made up everything in it, and I dropped it in the middle of the city, but then I spent years and a full solid year at the New York Public Library researching, you know, every street sign, walls with maps, you know, nobody makes a wrong left turn, you know, like this idea that everything, so to me, again, you know, yes, these women transmogrify into naked rabbis, but I still think it's within the realm of possibility.
You said earlier that there were a few stories in this book that terrified you to write. Which were they?
This is an awesome crowd. Yes, as said from the audience, Sister Hills was really like very... I've never not known what I had so much as what that story, the not knowing that that story necessitated.
Wait, I have to.
I know, I'm talking double and triple negatives. But the point is to not double back. Like, again, I wanted, you know, part of where I say different challenges, like, oh, how do I execute this moment? Or how do I turn these women into men? Or how do I get these people on the wrong train? Or the, you know, there's a deal in the story. It's about, you know, it's an, Back to Distance and Flips is a story set in Israeli settlements, and to me, I think it's really, for me, born of this past election year, which is really an election 4 years, but the idea of people's abuse of contracts to get what they want. You know, what I, you know, I'm really obsessed with social contracts. That's, you know what I'm saying? I don't scream about it a lot as a Jew, but like, you know, like the issues in the Catholic Church, like this idea, you know, I say it's between like, you know, priests and rabbis and school teachers and policemen. And that's a social contract, and I'm obsessed with the abuse of contracts and the abuse of the Bible. Most people scream and wave the Bible who want something out of it are just basing it on the assumption that whoever they're screaming at hasn't read the book. You know what I'm saying? But I guess, you know, to me, yeah, the challenge of the story was, you know, there's just endless, like the settlement, you know, conflict, it can't be figured out whether it's to be a greater Israel, whether a two-state solution, this thing, so much bloodshed, so much pressure, you know, so many years, just zillions of pages written all over the world every day. The New York Times might as well make it a separate section after the art section. You know what I'm saying? But like that idea, I thought, I'm going to tell the whole history of the settlements in a short story, because what is impossible is also possible. And to me, you know, this idea of raising the questions in the story, you know, why I'm not a mathematician or something, is I'm more interested in exploring questions and sharing all of us shared consciousness of us coming to the answers together. But to me, it demanded such a fine line that I was literally just, I couldn't sleep. The night I finished it, I did not sleep. I was just so upset because I just really didn't know what the story was or what it was doing. And I have to say, more than anything I've ever written ever, it's been functioning as a Rorschach test. Like, people come up to me and see it as a, you know, this is why we need a greater Israel. They see it as a right-wing defense of the settlements. They see it as a radically left-wing, you know, we need to pull out some arts, destroying the morality of the country. And maybe the people I like best are the ones who immediately come to me and assume it means the opposite of whatever it is they believe and want to argue.
It's interesting, because I read it, I mean, I'm obviously aware of those political components, but I read it all almost entirely on personal terms, in terms of the contract, the sort of the spirit of the contract.
Yes.
I'm trying to be vague for those who haven't read the story. And the tragedy, I mean, it's a tragic story in many ways. It's a tragedy.
Yes.
For everyone.
Yes.
What about a story like Everything I Know About My Family on My Mother's Side? This story interests me because it plays with a line, the line between invention and truth in literature, which is a line that fascinates me. You know, the narrator of the story is named Nathan.
Yeah.
You know, there is a sort of autobiographical frame, or the illusion of an autobiographical frame. There is this whole question of what stories mean and how they change. You know, the central story is what this character actually knows about his mother's side of the family turns out to constantly change throughout the story. I'm curious about your thoughts of sort of the evolution of that story. Was that also a story that was terrifying, or is that a story that...
No, it was... it's told in like 63 or 68 short chapters, like one paragraph chapters. I guess it was raised, and I was walking, we were talking about Alexander Hammond backstage, but I was interested in friends. I thought I couldn't be a writer growing up for the main reason that I grew up in suburbia and was raised by a television set. And I know everyone says, like, write what you know, write what you know. And I felt like, I don't even know anything, but what I know is not even the, you know what I'm saying? Like, my experiences weren't even my experiences, they're experiences watched on sitcoms, and they weren't even well-written, you know, sitcom, you know, so that idea of, like, my whole basic experience-based is, like, a poorly written non-experience of someone else acting an experience. I thought, this is not rich material, and I thought of friends, like, you know, who've had, you know, big personal histories or big family stories, you know, these Buddenbrooks friends were always able to write these giant, sprawling things, you know, and they're like, when my grandfather was a fur trader and invented soap, you know, and it's like, you know, and then you're like, oh, well, there's a novel for you, you know, but like, and I just decided, as the title states, like, it's a very literal book in that way, like, you know, it's called the stories, you know, Everything I Know About My Mother or My, you know, My Family on My Mother's Side, that literally it would not fit, like, our whole family history would not even fill a short story. And it was that exploration, because it's sort of the American dream. Like, and again, this is clearly cooking because I say it every night and I'm obsessed with it. I keep saying, like, I'm a fifth generation American. Like, you know, this idea that people say to me, where are you from? I say New York. And like, no, you know, they know I'm Jewish. Like, no, where are you from before that? I'm like, Boston. Like, that's as far, you know, as far back as I know. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, so, you know, I just really wanted to explore, you know, what it is, family memory, and how to construct it. But exactly what you're saying, you know, I try to be a cynical, horrible person, and if someone screams out a tragedy, scream out a personal tragedy, I will make a joke. You know what I'm saying? We can play that as a game. You know what I'm saying? But, like, I can't handle emoting in real life in that way. But you know, I'm so sincere about my belief in the reality of fiction and the role of fiction and what it does and what it means to me. Like, as I, you know, said before, we say, like, crazy thing, you know, these are fabled things, these are impossible things, like, not if you've built your story right. And I guess, you know, as it says in that story, I really believe there are singular truths and multiple realities. Like, that's how I see the world. You can't tell me two, you know what I'm saying, which is what frustrates me, again, back to, like, politics. Like, you can't, you know, there is no right side of, like, denying children health care. You're just wrong. Like, history says you're wrong. Morality says you're wrong. Religion says you're, you know, the idea of saying this is a way, you know, like, you're wrong. You're horribly, horribly wrong, and you're mean. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, you know what I'm saying? We're a rich country. You know what I'm saying? Like, children get to go to the doctor unless, you know, like, you really have to give up a lot before kids can't go to the doctor. Anyway, so that's, you know, so 2 + 2 = 4, like, that's a truth. But multiple realities is how we get into problems in the world. You know, like, that's the idea. Like, I'm just back from Jerusalem. I say, like, you'll be at the bus stop in Jerusalem, and I'll be in Jerusalem. Someone else is in Yerushalayim. Someone else is in Ilkutz. You know, it's like, and it's literally people, you know, and God, you know, bless America for trying to broker peace all the time, but half the time, like, it's, you know, this idea of not understanding, you're not on a spectrum. Mm-hmm. You are dealing with people who are not sharing a reality. And to me, it's like this idea where, you know, nonfiction people are always getting in trouble for it because they're, you know, come over to fiction side if you need to change something. There's room. But my point is, you know, in that story, I'm exploring this idea that there are dual truth. There's reality. The realities are shared, and I guess I'm exploring that space.
Well, and also that there's the fact, and then there's the truth, right? I mean, the facts may be malleable, or may be misremembered, or may be refiltered. But what's really important is what is the story that those facts are trying to tell.
And this is the point: is like, you know. Like, people are often telling the truth, and it is, you know, back to me remembering that Carver story where they see now with people, like, identifying people in police lineups, like, you watch it, you know, I literally, you know, I just had it, I'll say something on stage, and someone will say back to me something I've said now, and you can see they're telling the truth back to me, but the whole room be like, that's not what he said, you know, and say, like, no, that's what their brain heard, and that's, to make memory, we have to make order, and that's why family stories are grand, like, things don't make sense, and I think somebody's not lying, you know, when they, you know, even a friend, we were in a car in San Francisco, but, like, you know, Lester, and someone's, you know, was telling a family story, and the grandmother, she's maybe 2 years younger than the family's always celebrated her birthday, because otherwise, you know, dad would have been born at a little bit of a shaky, you know, period of memory. And even that, to me, an intentional changing of history that way, that is not a lie. You have a right to your privacy. Like, that's not hurt, you know, that is not breaking a social contract either. But the point is that then gets remembered a truth. And these alterations and changes and shifts of memory, to me, that's like a beautiful thing of how story forms. It's how we remember.
Right. I totally agree. Now, you've been working in the last couple of years in a variety of different forms.
Yes.
You've written a play. You did the translation of the Haggadah. I want to ask you a couple questions about that. But first, what was the impetus to move out of fiction, or not, I mean, not set fiction aside, but to sort of expand and work in other forms? And how did that come about?
Yeah, both. I have to say, just good fortune and me enjoying smart people. Like, when the first book came out, and I was still in, like, short pants, and you know, my agent called and said, you know, Nora Ephron wants to take you to lunch, and that's a crazy. See, back to, but this is the point: is regular reality is crazy that way. That's as crazy as the women turning to naked rabbis for me to suddenly be like, oh, Nora, like, that's my new life.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
So, but the point is, I took that lunch, and the idea is, you know, I just she's one of our, you know, great minds, and she saw in this story. She said, I read this story. You read your book, and there's a play in this story, and I want you to write. You know, to write it as a play. And, you know, again, I had no interest in theater. I have no experience in theater. I, you know, had no connection or drive towards theater, but it was recognizing, like, to work with this person, like, you know, if she said, like, let's paint a, like, we'll paint a mural. You know what I'm saying? Like, whatever she wanted, I was like, I would love to work with her. And she was very kindly. I said, I just want to go off and write my novel. And she said, great. I called the Rip Van Winkle contract. And 10 years later, I show up and she was there. But the point is, yes, it was for recognizing that this person has great instincts. And again, what's the, you know, she wasn't coming, you know, for, not coming to me for glory or to pay her rent or anything like that, to recognize this is a person, like, that was the biggest lesson of all this stuff, what I learned from her, like, why she was, you know what I'm saying, here she is, she's a director, but she's a screenwriter, but she's an essayist, but she's a novelist, but she's a producer, but she's a player. I didn't understand, I was so singular, like, the 10 years I was writing the novel, I would say, like, brush my teeth or write today, like put on pants or write. I just had no interest in doing two things at once a day. It wasn't even possible, but I didn't understand how people function that way. And then I understood, which is the answer to this question, that she saw her place, you know, like, why come to me? She doesn't need to pick up the phone, you know, because she saw her job, I believe, as putting story into the world. And like, that was a really freeing thing for me to understand. And the same with the Haggadah, which is, you know, Jonathan Safran Foer is a friend. And again, I'm, you know, I'm not religious anymore. I did not want to spend, you know, 3 years with 3,000 words, you know.
It took 3 years to do the translation.
Yeah, yeah, I spent probably 3 years on it. Nice. 6 weeks on the initial translation. It's only 3,000 words. But then, again, I get obsessed with projects. And I felt like, you know, I grew up using the Hebrew and Aramaic side. I thought, wait a second, people who don't have access to that side are going to be praying with the words I choose, or that this idea is a first translation trial. It's basically a Reader's Digest of the Bible of Exodus, you know what I'm saying? So the idea is a first translation project and challenge. How does one translate the Bible? You know, like, these words have very distinct meaning to me and feeling to me, like, to do. So yes, 6 weeks plus 3 years to do this very, very tiny book. But in both cases, it was about wanting to work with people that I would love to work with. And right. And I have to say, it changed the way I work. It changed the way I think. You know, it brought this book would have taken me 10 years. I wrote most of it in a year. And it was because of those projects. My whole goal is to protect my writing time. And I was very afraid to agree to both of those because they're going to steal from my fiction writing time. And I didn't understand that they would make more time. And I think a lot of it was, you know, and anyone who wants to be a writer in here, I'll do like a blanket thing, like, you're all writers, I license you. But like, you know, but so much of life is this fear of wanting, I want to be a writer, I want to be this, I want to be like a director. Like, it's very, things are very, you know, it just reminded me about these struggles with identity again. Like, I literally couldn't, you know, they were worried, as you can see, I don't have a problem talking, but I went into the public the first time. I couldn't look in the camera. They were really nervous about me promoting the play because I couldn't look in the camera and say, my name is Nathan and I am a playwright. Like, it's like going to AA the first time. Like, I would say, like, you know, I just couldn't say it because it's like this idea of identity. And then I understood, if I'm spending all day translating, I must be a translator. If I'm writing a play and there's actors acting, I must be a playwright. And it really reminded me back to that pure form, back to that feeling of being alone in my room, dreaming of being, thinking that someone's going to make me a writer or license me. That if you're writing, you know, the very point of the play and of that short story, which is about in 1952, Stalin killed the last, it's called The Night of the Murdered Poets, but it was very unknown that Stalin killed the last of the Yiddishists, executed them. And, you know, and I wanted to, nobody had ever written them a story. These people were utterly forgotten. You know, it's just starting to come up more and more. But at the time, like, very few people in the universe even knew about this. I heard it from a Russian expert in Jerusalem when I was 19. But you know, that short story is three writers in a cell, ancient legendary writers, who at the time I pictured them as like 38 or 40 in the play. I'm like, they're 120 and the young writer's 57. Anyway, but at the time, and a young writer, unknown, gets thrown in with them and he's never been read. He's written all his life and he's never been read, you know, and he wants to, you know, never published a word. No one's ever, you know, seen or anything he's written. And he wants to know from these heroes, like, is it as a writer that I die? And that, the point is, that's the question of the story for me, which I deeply believe no one ever has to see your work. Like, there is, it reminded me of that feeling of that question that I'd long ago explored, which is like, there is nothing but the act of creation.
Right. And it's a remarkable idea because the story, or the act of writing, or story, because he creates a story, right, that becomes, yes, both his salvation, becomes his salvation, but it also doesn't save him. You know, it saves him on one level, but it doesn't, yeah, save him on another level, which is a fascinating kind of dual vision there. What you're saying, it seems to me, is that it is in the doing, right? So you're a playwright because you're writing a play. It's that we get hung up on these labels, or we sort of try and think our way into these roles, and that becomes the paralyzing thing.
They're empowering at some point, you know what I'm saying? Like, and then they become suffocating and limiting, and you know why I'd be resistant to be like framed as any kind of but this is the point, is like, I know you teach, I know you write, like, I know you review, like, most of these people know you as like, you are the interviewer, I'm the interviewee, like, that is our current identity. If I start running around the stage, I am a runner, you, right, know what I'm saying? Like, you know, it's very, to me, that's like a giant, I can't tell you, it was like a massive artistic moment to like understand, you know, that is all there is. And back to like truths, you know, truths and realities, also ideas of loyalty and betrayal, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, if I say, like, you know, you're my boyfriend and I swear my, you know, love to you and that you are my world, you know, like, and then I go over there and you see me making out with somebody else, like, that's a betrayal. Right. But for me, it was also really freeing that, like, we're talking about the stories tonight. I will tell you, there is no, you know, it is the greatest form in the world. It is the purest form. It is the large, you know, it is like there is nothing but short story as pressurized form on language, as organic storytelling, as symbols on a page and how we build realities in our head. Like I will, and I mean that to the bottom of my heart. And it was wonderful for me to work in theater and to be obsessed with the play. And I will tell you there, if we're talking about, if you ask me about the play now, then I'm like, there is no greater form than live theater, than real people in front of a room and it, creating a reality together in a shared space. And to me that like, it was wonderful to see that that is not the betrayal of me.
Right, those are the multiple realities.
Yeah, like you can hold that, that it was wonderful for me to see, like translation, giving voice to, you know, something else, you know, the weight of it. So that was a great thing to see that, it, you know, yeah, that shift, that there is room in the world to be all these things.
Now, we were talking earlier, or not earlier, but even before we came out, about the idea of doing, and you were sort of alluding to it just before, about doing multiple projects and even multiple projects in very different kind of forms and how that rather than being distracting, it kind of, it's actually creative, it's a creative foment, that it they help each other. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and we were talking, you know, before just even about lighting, like, A, working with brilliant people, like they did for me. I almost, you know, wept that first day, like, at the, you know, I've been working on this play for years and the story at 19, so it's like half my life living with this story. And then for the, you know, the costumer to come in, the costume designer, and bring in, like, here, I dreamed this thing my whole life, and then this woman has spent, she has researched, like, the murdered writers. She's found, like, every picture of them over, she's done, like, a, you know, these charts of everything they've worn, you know, through their life, and then dummied up, like, singular outfits for this, like, that someone had taken something I dreamed and dreamed a specific element of it. I literally almost started weeping, and one thing, you know, like suddenly I saw a Lenin Prize that you get, the big literary prize that, you know, on a lapel. And I literally, you know, I literally almost started weeping. And then I looked at that Lenin Prize and she saw my face and she said, $22,000 on eBay. Because I immediately was like, I got to buy one. They're very expensive. They're made of platinum. She saw, I was like, I think I need a Lenin Prize. Anyway, but the other thing was like that idea that I went home and started rewriting the play immediately because that prize written is a different thing to see it on a lapel. Like it was just to me the shared that everyone, all of us, you know, it's not my play, it was our play. It's the actors, it's the lighting. You know, like that was joyous to me. You know, and the other thing is about, and you know, getting back to touchy feely, is I really have gotten more obsessed with what happens when we write. You know, and I, you know, the like example I use is writing Sister Hills, where I'd been suffering, like it's really, I've become obsessed with this idea, which is, you know, when a writer is writing something and suffering for a few days and wondering, like, how am I going to figure this out? You should never be able to figure, if you don't know something, you're working on a story and you can't figure it out on Friday, you should never be able to figure it out on Monday. It's not like something you can look up or read another book to find. You've made it, I have access to, there is no information that I do not have. I've made it all up, the universe, everything. So how could I possibly ever know something like a day later that I didn't know the day before? It's not, it's literally not possible. You know, so what makes that possible is only the understanding of, like, how consciousness works and the unconscious. And I literally, you know, like, the example is I was sitting there suffering with, you know, Sister Hills for days. And, like, that last day, like, it was 9 p.m. I had been sitting there for 12 hours, probably day three. And then I was, you know, typing the rest of this story, like, figuring out, like, suddenly it's, you know, as fast as I can typing and, you know, not even enough time to finish the sentences, like bits of like description and dialogue, like basically typing out a map for the rest of the story that I would then use to finish the whole story. But, you know, sitting there and like I'm doing that thing where I'm like, stay calm, you know, like it's happening. Like I'm just trying not to jar myself from this moment, you know, right? Like I'm sitting there and I'm the me that's talking to you, I'm sitting there and thinking like, stay calm. You seem to be getting it. Your hands are flying, like it's getting written. But the point is, if that's what I am thinking, the me that is talking to you, who's typing the story? You understand, like, somebody's typing words, and I am just sitting in my seat saying, like, don't, you're going to get a few more minutes out of it. Like, if you don't bump this, you might get everything you need. So my point is, that is literally, you know, and we don't have time, but I talked about this neuroscientist that I talked to about this, you know, but it's literally, it's a disassociative state writing. We all, what he said, you know, we all daydream, we all lose consciousness, and we obviously, we can't be aware of being unconscious, so we think we're conscious all the time when we are not conscious a lot of the time, which is why I do not text and drive. You're not that fast when you come back to the window. But the point is, it's like you are literally, you know, he said, he was very calm about it, but it's literally, you know, what a writer is trained into, like him or herself or third sex or whatever you want. But the point is, what a writer has trained herself to do is to sit there and engage with the disassociative state. We all dream. It's learning to type to engage with the subconscious, like people who have lucid waking dreams, which I'm very jealous of. You know, so I really think that that idea of working between forms, actually, when you're doing the other thing, some other part is working the other form. It actually, you know, it sounds, as I said, really touchy-feely, but I, you know, in practice, I see that they all feed each other in a giant loop, you know. And we know that in life. It's like, you know, I'm a bad museum goer, and every once in a while I get to the Met or MoMA. I'm like, why don't I come here every day? You know, I get there, and then I look, and then my brain's on fire. Like, it's, you know, jarring, looking at other forms, dealing with other forms. You think you don't have time for those things? Like, make time for those things.
Well, this has been great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.
We will keep going, but we'll keep going with you guys. So we have microphones in the audience. Raise your hands. We'll call on you. We'll bring you a microphone. Wait till you get the microphone so that we can record it.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Do you write as fast as you talk?
That is a very fair question. And I am hated. I'm going to Europe again for more translations in a couple of weeks. The simultaneous translators truly loathe me. It's really hard to do this at the same time in another language if it's not your head at the same time. I try to slow down. But yeah, I wrote the first two books longhand. I would write a chapter longhand and then or a short story, and then I would type it up and mark up that chapter and then rewrite the whole thing and then retype the whole thing. So yeah, for many years it was very helpful for me to, you know, for the last, you know, almost 20 years to write longhand to slow things down. But yeah, now I type, and yeah, I decided to go with it, and then I wrote this book in a year. So,
When the two survivors meet each other, the one who is number 5 and the one who is number 8,
yes.
Did you have alternate ways in your mind that it could have gone? You know, like when he said, "You cut in line, you cut in line in front of me." Did you have alternates, or did you come up with that immediately?
By the time it was there, I mean, a lot, you know, and we started out the talk this way, and it's a very, you know, when we talk about sharing realities, like I've been with this book, you know, I took this book, you know, it was one thing to talk about this book in Amsterdam, and it was another to talk about it in Vienna, and, you know, it's a very loaded thing to, you know, stand there in Berlin and, you know, read that paragraph. People, like, they do not laugh at that in Berlin, you know what I'm saying? You know, and with good reason, you know what I'm saying? Like, don't laugh, you know, too soon. Anyway, but yeah, I guess that was how that, I can't tell you now, after the fact, it's all clear in reverse form. There was probably an infinite number of versions, but then it becomes the version, and then I can't remember any other option. But I think how that paragraph gets allowed is really, like, I think, to me, that kind of story is really how people who are tied to the Holocaust, you know, in my world, how they really deal with it. You know, it is so, you know, so much death, so much destruction, the whole shape of the planet changed, the whole history of Judaism and the Romani people and everything changed from it. And to me, to deal, I guess the way I see, you know, if we're talking about reality a lot, that anyone I know takes it so seriously that you know, the more serious you take it, the darker the joke is the way, you know, I experience the world and the people. Because sometimes people say how, you know, they want to know, you know, I always say, like, you know, back to not having a Jewish pope, like, people come up to me like, do you own the Holocaust? You know, this idea, how can you do that? And I'm like, actually, how can you not do that if you actually, you know, have any connection to the thing or the people who survived it? And yeah, that is how I see how people survive with that memory in the world that I am in.
Hey, Nathan, how's it
going?
Hey,
how are you?
Good to see you. Can I ask you kind of a literary critic question?
Is that a really violent thing to do?
Yeah. No. It's also a question about Ministry of Special Cases, if that's allowed tonight.
Deal.
Okay. For those of you who've read The Ministry of Special Cases, it's about a disappeared Jewish Argentine boy during the Dirty War in Argentina. It's a fascinating novel. I don't know if you've read your friend's novels, Rivka Galchen's Atmospheric Disturbances.
She was my student. No
and
less.
Nicole Krauss's Great House, but they too have kind of disappeared Southern Cone characters
right.
in Rivka's book. the wife, right, disappears, and she's Argentine. And sorry? Yeah. And so this is a literary critic question. I warned you. Yeah. And in Nicole Krauss's book, also, there's the Daniel Varsky, the disappeared Chilean poet. So you kind of talked about how there's no such a thing as a Jewish writer, but here are these kind of strange Jewish American writers who are all kind of compelled by the idea of disappearance. And I wonder, other American writers aren't writing about the disappeared as a trope.
Sure. Or Oh, good. I never think I'm going to be able to... That I can answer. But that's a literary question I can answer, which is that is not... When we are searching for... I can tell you what happens as a writer. Like, I just threw out, before I left for Israel, I threw out 200 pages of novel that I'd been working on, and I was like, which is very freeing and wonderful. For me, it felt fast because I would have, you know, spent another 10 months usually throwing out that 200 pages, but I feel like I really efficiently threw out that 200 pages. But then I got a new idea, and suddenly everything in the newspaper, like everything was, oh my God, I have notes on that. I have pieces of that. Like, when you're excited, I'll be like, I can't believe he's wearing those shoes. Like, that's exactly what I needed. Like, everything, just because you make an order doesn't mean, you know, the searching for patterns, it's like, right? Because there's orderly patterns, logical patterns, and then people who go mad and find, you know, then they find messages in the news, you know, like, or, you know, like, or you can do the mechanics of a novel. My point is, there are very logical, what you're saying sounds very smart to me and very well observed to me, but is none of my business and not any conscious shared thing. So it's like, so my point is that framing might be a really, because my point is these are both close friends of mine. I know their lives, our lives can't be any more different. Like she said, Rivka Galchin, she literally have to be like, Rivka, this is a challah that we eat on Shabbos. Like she has an Israeli name. She grew up in Oklahoma. Like she has no, you know what I'm saying? Like we have no background the same at all. You know what I'm saying? And Nicole Krauss grew up a few miles from me, but a different universe, a public school. You know, like, so my point is, yes, we're all Jewish, but they're women. I'm a man. So that breaks it. Like, or you could frame it like two of us are Long Island raised. Like my point is I can shift the order around for the order. There might be something that links through Judaism, but it might be through age or it might be through sex. But then I shake that up. Like, I don't know what makes these orders or which pattern to search for. That might really be a Jewish pattern. But the question, the thing to explore would be how do three such different Jews end up with that same interest? And maybe because we have coffee together too much. Like that, see, that's my other point, which is when groups form, right? I was her teacher. So like, how does that mean me screaming at her for a semester? Maybe I scream, disappear people, you know, like, you know. So yeah, I think there is something to that, but to me it would muddle. That is never my concern.
Hi, thank you so much for talking to us tonight. Oh, I have a few questions. Who are your favorite living writers? Who are your favorite dead writers? And how has being part of a group in New York of writers impacted you?
Yeah. The nice thing, and it's always, I always say with writing, like, doing the thing that is nicest and most generous and most monkish is also the same as doing the most competitive. It's always good to do that. But writers are a sensitive bunch. I really almost never pick living writers. Like, I wouldn't give you my real list because then everyone's so sensitive and they'd be like, why aren't I on your list? Like, I didn't think of you that night. I thought of you in the next city. I said you were my favorite writer. But, you know, but I'm happy with iconic people, you know, like, you know, Marilyn Robinson, who was my teacher. That's like a life-changing writer for me. Like, you know, Philip Roth is turning 80 this month. Like that, you know, he's a life-changing living writer for me. You know, like, those people are safe. You know, no one's gonna argue, you know. Now Yale Doctorow or someone will be like, why didn't you say me? You know, I love ragtime. You know what I'm saying? Like Toni Morrison, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, to get, see, then I'll have to list people all night for fear of, I list every living writer as my favorite living writer. But dead writers, yeah, I love all the hard constants like Kafka, Camus, Conrad, like I love, you know, Flannery O'Connor, Raymond Carver, you know, Kiever. Anyway, but the point is, yeah, I read broadly and wildly and love all that stuff. And I have to say, like, I've been traveling a ton, and out of my wife's getting a PhD in Madison, we spend a lot of time in the Midwest now, but in Lori Moore country. But the point, yeah, I have to say, it's the dumbest city in the world for writers to live in because everything, we are mobile. Like, you know, everything's wildly expensive. It's just wildly expensive. It's like living in a pressure cooker. You're aware of all kinds of stuff that shouldn't be on your radar. But yet, I find it an unbelievably friendly time, cross-generationally. You know, you can, you know, make your grid however you want. I really feel like it's a lovely, supportive time among writers. I can't even tell you how much it enriches my life. I'm really thankful. We really all do hang out in a big, nauseating pile, but it really does, it is vibrant to me.
I heard an interview with Zadie Smith where she said that she and you have a sort of informal competition about how many of your students become writers.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you had ever talked to her about what it means to be a writer.
You know what? I think I love these friendships mean really a lot to me, but I have to say we do not, you know what I'm saying? I have a writer's poker game that's probably like a dozen years old at this point. Like, we talk about other stuff. I really think it's the support of doing I think we talk about the psychology of things and nobody's talking about writing all the time in a very strange way. But I think it's, you know, we're all there. Maybe the best way to call it is like, we're never talking about writing, but it's like a big giant sleeper cell. You know what I'm saying? And that in moments of like psychic pain, you can call someone up. Or in a moment like you need something, you know, Letham, who's now out here, like he's good, like he moved out west, like suddenly, you know, I didn't spoke to him in a while, like a short story shows up, like you're, you know, this one's written for, you know, I think you're the one to read this, you know, can you read this for me? Like, and I feel like that's the lovely thing. Like, we do read for each other, we are there for each other. But for me, I think the main discussion that you call about craft, it's not really craft talk. I think it's really about, you know, the day-to-day psychological engagement with the work, which is the hard, you know, it's a joyous life, it's a wonderful life, but it's a life without boundaries and without day or night, and I think that's the hardest, it's the mechanics of the day that it really helps to share.
Right over here. Hello.
Over there.
You seem to be one of the most thoroughly good people who's at home and comfortable with cruelty and evil. And I'm just wondering, what's the most surprising thing that cruelty's ever taught you or what you've discovered about cruelty?
Oh, my God, that's a tough one. A question about, like, what's the most surprising thing I discovered about cruelty? But, this takes us back to the beginning of the talk and me sitting in that table in Berlin. It's, you know, it's very strange to give in to one's brain, and we'll see if it changes and if I start writing baseball books or get very concerned with, like, genetic engineering of corn crops and corn fertilizers. Like, but right now I seem to be, yes, very obsessed with ideas of justice and injustice. So it's, yeah, I don't think, my point is the element you're talking about is surely a huge element of the work, but I think what I'm exploring is, like, you know, how do we deal with justice? How do we deliver vengeance? I have no answers to these questions. I think that's the idea. And back to this woman's question about the writers I love, when I was a religious kid and struggling, and I'd still be a religious kid, I think in a different scenario, now I'd be a religious man. But I think it was this idea of having huge questions that were threatening and finding that there are no answers, but finding that in literature, people are not afraid to wrestle with these very scary. So I think in a sense, yeah, I surely would never pose an answer now, but it's simply to me that life, this is the thing that interests me in life, is really trying to honestly explore those questions. Thank you.
Yeah, in the back.
Thank you for coming. I first read your Free Fruit for Widows in The New Yorker.
Yes.
And it was a marvelous story, just a fantastic
story.
Thank you. But what impressed me beyond the storyline and the language that you used is you're lacing the story with Hebrew expressions and not necessarily defining them in a context. And I thought, wow, how does that reflect upon you, your writing and your comfort?
Right.
And how does that reflect upon your readers, specifically the readers that you expect to open your story in The New Yorker?
And good for The New Yorker for being open to that stuff now, and same with, you know, whether it's Juno Diaz writing, you know, having Spanish words. But I guess I think endlessly about language and about terms. You know what, like, we all... People ask that question, like, can I give this book to my Gentile friend? You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, and it's that idea, like, if a story is functioning, it's universal. We all, you know, read so broadly. Most everything we read, you know, most everything I read is in translation, so far from my own experience. And it's this idea, only when we talk about certain things do we think, does this one group story transfer to another large group story? But my point is, I don't know anything about sports. Like, you know, I like The Natural. You know what I'm saying? Like, different people bring different things to a different book, you know? And the idea is everyone has a different, you know, access to language and words. How do you control someone's vocabulary? So my idea, I really feel like, you know, or even the idea of the Russians that I love. I don't speak French. Like, I don't feel frustrated when there's four lines of Dostoevsky in French. Like, you know, woven into his English translation of the Russian. You know, like, it's the fluidity of language, the fluidity of knowledge, and that you better control your sentence. You know what I'm saying? Everyone better have access. If someone picks it up and puts that in their mouth and swallows it, like, it's probably not a golf ball. If they don't fall over, it's probably, you know, it's probably food if they seem happy. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, this idea is, you know, things are explained in context, and if they are not, then you must give the key. So I feel like everything should work for it. Yes, I'm very aware of that, but that idea of sucking the life out of language to me is like a sad notion. You know what I'm saying? Like, this idea, I was just talking about even, you know, translation, like, I won't go into translation for 9 hours. The point is, yes, I feel like we all bring a specific read to a specific story, and that's, we were just talking about Mildred Pierce. I don't know anything. I'm so happy. I'm in love with this city. I want a house with a fruit tree. It's like so exciting for me in LA. I've been in Madison. It's like minus 20 degrees. The dog is shivering. But the point is, like, I just was telling him how much we both love Mildred Pierce, we admit to you publicly. I outed you. But
that's fine.
The point is, for me to read that book, like, how can I enjoy Mildred Pierce? I'm not picturing the streets. I don't know LA. For me, it's a joyous book. I just, for him, teaching, you know, like, you know, somebody who loves this city, knows the city, it's an utterly different experience. But the point is, we other bring, you know, I bake a mean apple pie, so maybe I have more pie experience than you. You know what I'm saying? Like, we all bring a different thing to a different book.
And we can meet in the center. Right?
Yes.
In the center.
If it's functioning.
If it's functioning, yeah. We have time for one last question, so.
I just wanted to ask you what you're reading right now for pleasure, not your favorite writers or anything, but just what are you reading?
Yeah, I'm not reading for pleasure now. I'm reading for ideas in like a crazy manner. I'm rereading books like this sounds super farty. Like I brought like Turgenev again. I hadn't read in 20 years, and I'm reading a couple of Roth books that you know I want to see that I haven't. I'm reading The Counterlife again. I guess I was just in Israel, and it's like, you know, I'm thinking of ideas of Israel and how it does not change, and it's almost heartbreaking to read a book that's like 30 years old and it's the same exact issues today, but compounded. And so, but yeah, I was reading a lot. As I said, I was, you know, reading Philip K. Dick, The Android's Dream, Electric Sheep. I just finished and loved that. And the Mildred Pierce, and you know, all over. Bad answer. It's like the video store question. Remember video stores? And then like somebody would call you at home. I'm at the video store. What do you want? And all I can think of is like Saturday Night Fever. I can't, you know. So I promise you, I read books. But right now, you ask me, I can't see anything at all. Anyway, thank you all for having me.
Thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.